Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions, and this is an episode of the Open Books series in which we get to know fascinating and inspiring people in the insurance and actuarial community through the books that they have read and loved. Today I'm joined by Prabhashini Moodley. Prabhashini is an experienced and versatile financial services executive with over 23 years of experience across the Old Mutual Group. She was appointed Chief Executive Officer, Life and Savings Cluster in August 2025. Prabhashini joined the group in 2002 and has had various roles across actuarial, distribution, strategy, and investments. Prabhashini has a passion for leadership innovation and driving sustainable business value. As the Group Executive Committee sponsor of actuarial professionals, she contributes to the overall community development and value proposition for actuaries at Old Mutual. In addition, she has sat on multiple subsidiary boards and currently chairs specialist remuneration consultancy REM Channel. In her free time, she enjoys traveling, reading, of course, and spending quality time with family and friends. Welcome to the podcast, Prabhashini.
Thank you so much, Pam. It's lovely to be here.
So I know you enjoy reading in your free time, but would you say that you're a reader with a capital R?
I don't think recently I've been a reader with a capital R, and not because I haven't been reading, but most of my reading has been work-related. So it's a lot of reading of papers for committees and board packs. I recently completed my MBA, so it was a lot of case study reading. So I have been doing a lot of reading, but not enough of the kind that I just love and do for enjoyment.
Okay, well, hopefully today we'll, you know, revive that reader in you, because this isn't a typical podcast interview, and that we will get to know you and the things you're busy with the added angle of books that have shaped you in some way. So you can think of it as the Desert Island Discs for bibliophiles. But before we get into the books, we're recording in October 2025, and you were recently appointed Chief Executive of a Life and Savings Cluster at Old Mutual. So does that basically mean you're the boss at Mutual? Or why
means,
is that wrong?
It means I have a lot of work. So it's a newly created role. I started in the role on the 1st of August, so I'm in my third month. It puts together our life and savings business units in South Africa. So it's a lot of amazing people, a lot of amazing things, and we're busy organizing ourselves for how we want to operate and compete into the future. Yeah, so I sit in a lot of meetings. I'm in lots of town halls, Teams calls, but also have the fun job, I think, to come of really influencing what we do in the life and savings space.
Okay, and as part of the intro, we said that you are sort of responsible for the value proposition of actuaries at Old Mutual. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so it's a very fancy way of saying I just make sure that at Group Exco, we remember that we have this very special community. And, you know, all of our people are special, but actuaries kind of, you know, are at the core of life insurance businesses. And we have a very vibrant community at Old Mutual who like to engage. And I make sure that I open doors for us to have different executives, create different exposure, support things that the community is interested in. And I really just create the platform to ensure that ideas and initiatives that come up through the community get the right airtime. And we also listen to what would add value to people. One of the ideas that came out of our actuarial community was the idea of setting up the internal consultancy unit. So it's listening for things like that and how we can make work more meaningful for our actuarial community.
Yeah. So I want to get into the books that you brought along, but we're going to warm up by talking about some of your reading habits. So what genres do you typically enjoy reading?
Apart
from case studies.
From case studies and board reports. I've recently started reading a lot more nonfiction, but maybe it's more books around history, but history as it relates to the economy, things around, you know, different parts of the world and how they've evolved and how they've developed. So I've read recently around China, around Singapore. And it's just from a curiosity of how different parts have developed very differently. You know, we a lot of business that we do has a very Western slant and the Western, maybe American, British style. And maybe this is through the MBA, just being exposed to different economies, different societies, and how they've evolved. I like a very good fiction novel as well. So growing up, I loved Jane Austen. I loved light fiction. I can read the occasional thriller, but I'd say I'm more for a story with very vivid character development and that just transports you into a different world.
It's like literary fiction rather than genre.
Yeah.
I think of it as like these like thrillers or crime books are so tempting and easy to read, but afterwards you don't feel great. It's like junk food compared to like a wholesome meal of like a good, you know, literary novel.
It's an interesting way of putting it.
Not that I've given it any thought, right? So if you were to write a book, what do you think the genre would be?
Oh, wow.
Topic?
Oh, wow. That's very, very interesting. I think I'd want to write something that was like complete fantasy, which is that I've never thought about that before. So this is just what's coming to mind.
You heard it here first.
You heard it here first on the Open Books podcast. Yeah, so maybe something that's fantasy. I also think something that's a bit reflective and learnings and experiences. I've enjoyed recently reading people's autobiographies and stories. Mm. It gives a lot of insight. It also makes things more accessible, because sometimes you think, you know, someone's circumstances are so different from yours and you haven't had those experiences, and you can read their stories and find that there can be things that are quite similar. So maybe something reflective, not an autobiography, but something a little bit of learnings and reflections.
Okay.
I think I might. Yeah.
Yeah, the next project.
Not for a long time.
Do you seek out or do you avoid hyped books?
It's a bit of a mix. Sometimes I do seek out a hyped book, but it depends where the hype came from.
Okay.
If I've spotted it somewhere, like it's on one of those lists of books you have to read, and then I hear about it from someone else, maybe someone who's actually read it, then I might seek it out. Sometimes I actively go and look for lists because I know I'm looking for something specific. Hmm. So it's a bit of a mix. There are a few hyped books I just avoid because I think it's just hype.
Ooh, likewise.
Some of these, you know, where they'll say, you know, it might be like a must, where they've taken a topic that's quite intense and maybe made it a little bit, it's accessible, but it's almost too superficial.
Like pop science.
Yeah, okay. I might like, you know, I'll pass.
And then we briefly discussed this off camera, but for the audience, do you like physical books, Kindle, audiobooks? What's your reading style?
I do love physical books, but I think just with travel and for convenience, I did Kindle for a long time, but recently I've gotten into Audible. I actually get quite disappointed then when there's a book that I'm looking to read, but it isn't available on Audible. It's just convenient. So I just need my ear pods, and whether I'm in a queue or, you know, on a plane or even in the car, I can just listen to it. It doesn't make up for the feel of a physical book.
Okay.
But I am leaning more to Audible at the moment. Yeah.
A controversial question, but do you sniff books?
No. Pam, do you?
Me neither. Yes,
I do look at the cover. I am influenced by the cover. I will look at the cover. I will look at the back cover. I will read it. I'll open a book. I'll read a couple of paragraphs in it and not just go by the back cover. But I have not sniffed a book yet. No.
I'm waiting to think about it.
I am.
Okay, so let's get into books. What's the first one we're going to talk about?
So the first book I want to talk about, I didn't actually bring it because I don't have it. Yeah. It was my sister's book, and it's Little Women by Louisa M. Alcott. I think I must have been about 9 or 10 years old when I read it. It was my sister's, and it was just the storytelling and the creation of a different world. And it has, you know, I think it was around that age, and that was one of the books where I appreciated being transported into. You're almost like in the home with the family, and I think it was also just the similarity that I am one of four sisters, and therefore sisters in Little Women. I mean, of course, we weren't American. My dad wasn't away at the war or anything. But just that and the friendship and how each of them, you know, had a different personality. I found it a very, it was one of the early reads that stuck with me, and I reread quite a few times growing up.
Which of the sisters do you identify with or as?
It's interesting because Emmy was the youngest and I'm the youngest, but she was quite spoiled, which I like to believe I'm not. I'm an atypical youngest child, which is my belief. I don't know what
that's... Stick to it.
I'm sticking to it. I quite like Joe.
She was a Winona character. The Winona Ryder character.
In the movie. So she was a bit more... enjoyed her own company. She was into writing. I'm not a writer, but I quite liked her. Her independence and her spirit.
They've recently made another movie adaptation, right?
Where did they have? I didn't watch the recent one. I've watched the one with Winona Ryder, but I'm looking to watch the newer one. Yeah, I don't think that adaptation matches the book.
Okay.
But it's still a good movie and a good story.
Okay, and perhaps on the topic of childhood and growing up, can you share a bit about your background and how you came into that serial world?
It was a book, actually, not a reading book, but so I grew up in a small town in KZN, and the youngest of four, and my mom loved reading. She absolutely loved reading and took us to the library every weekend, and going to the bigger library into a bigger town was like quite a adventure, and we'd always get the four books you were allowed, and so that was fun. And I started when I was a bit younger. My sister actually used to get them, which was a mathematical digest. So it's a quarterly book. Yeah. And it was literally, it was a little thing, and it would be stapled. It wasn't a fancy. It was a quarterly book with lots of maths problems, and you could practice for maths Olympiads and so on. And on the back cover, there was a description of this career called actuarial science. And it said, do you like mathematics? Are you good at solving problems? Do you da da da? Then maybe this is the career for you. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Maybe. This was pre-email. The address of the Actuarial Society of South Africa was on there. And I was like, if you would like more information, please write. So I literally wrote a letter and I received a book.
About in high school.
Yes, okay. This was in high school. So that was my introduction to the profession. And that's when I decided, that's maybe this is for me. There were a couple of other things, but I didn't really appeal. And from there applied to university, applied for a couple of bursaries. I got the Old Mutual one, and that's been that.
Well, I feel like the Old Mutual bursary is also advertised in the...
It was.
That's still done.
Yes.
I think that's
how
I found out about it.
Yes. Okay. So it was the bursary advertised and said, if you want to know more about the profession, you can write to the Actuarial Society.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was interesting.
And then once you started university, did you enjoy your varsity experience? Were you like, this is the course for me? Or did you just sort of, go with the flow and figure it out as you went along?
So, when you get to university and you realize, how intense the course is, and all your friends, the friends from I lived in Rez, so my friends who weren't in the actuarial science degree had lots of free time. I was at UCT, so people sit on jammy stairs. I think I sat on jammy stairs twice.
Probably waiting for an exam to start.
Probably. It was first year was quite an experience. So it was far away from home. I'd never been away from home. I loved the overall experience of being at university in Cape Town. I made really good friends who are still friends of mine. I think even after graduation, after the 4-year degree, I was not sure if I would make it. You do all the exams, you get your exemptions at university, but you still know there's still a long way to go. And I, even though I'd done a few vacation work stints, I still didn't know if I had what it takes, and I still didn't know if I would enjoy it. I didn't. So I actually feel quite grateful that after, and I started in a life insurance team doing valuations, so surrounded by lots of life insurance actuaries, and I actually started enjoying the work, and I was very grateful because I thought it could have gone either way.
Yeah,
it could have really gone either way.
And you know, you've had so many roles across the business. Did you always have a plan? You know, there's obviously a new role that's been created, but did you have more or less a plan of where you wanted to get to?
No, I think I always wanted to do interesting work. I always Old Mutual's so massive, and I suppose lots of the larger corporates are similar. There's lots of opportunities to learn and grow. Mm. So almost every time I got a little itchy, there were opportunities in the broader group. So I went from the life insurance space into our investments business, which was a complete, you know, and in my thinking, it was, okay, you've spent lots of time on the liability side of the balance sheet. Go understand what happens with the assets. So I think it was curiosity drove a lot of my interest and maybe agitation to move around. And then having really good mentors and managers, I do feel quite fortunate. I always had people who encouraged me. I always had people who, if they spotted opportunities or, you know, they would take the interest to say, maybe you would like this, maybe you would like that. I was quite itchy when I was younger. I moved every two and a half, maybe the longest would be 3 years. I moved around. But that was excellent. You know, I had actually more non-actuarial roles than actuarial roles.
Interesting.
Yeah. So my time in distribution, in investments, those weren't actuarial roles. It was helpful that I'd studied actuarial science, but I think it was more the curiosity and wanting to learn and ambition. I was ambitious, but I didn't have a end, you know,
of your plan.
No, it was more if I'm learning and I'm growing, then
so
that was
go where your instincts or interests hit.
Yeah, you. And where the opportunities appeared.
And then when did you move to Joburg?
It's been like over 15 years.
Oh,
it was a long time. I moved to Joburg before the World Cup.
Okay.
So that's like the marker in my brain. I think it was 2008. I moved to Johannesburg in 2008, and then I was there through the World Cup. I went away for just under 3 years to Mexico, which was wonderful.
Time. Okay.
Which was also, it was a secondment opportunity that came up. And I was like, okay. So it's just being open to opportunities and being a little bit adventurous. And you know, lots of moves were sideways moves. They weren't always upwards moves. But, you know, with enough of the sideways moves comes the opportunity for the upwards moves. Yeah, so I've been in Joburg 2008 minus a few years.
Okay. Yeah. Still thriving. Back to Little Women. You said that you've reread it, you know, multiple times. Is that a habit of yours? Do you often reread books, or is there something sort of specific about this book that makes you come back to it?
I think with that book, it's just the writing is beautiful, the story is beautiful. I tend to reread when I'm taking a bit of a break, so when I'm on leave. And maybe there's something psychological in that also, that, you know, it's a memory of a particular time, of being relaxed, of being happy, of being younger. So I think different books at different times. Interestingly, there have been other books where I've just struggled to get beyond, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, struggle to get beyond like a first chapter, or I just keep getting stuck. And then, you know, there'll be some time I pick it up and, you know, the timing is just right.
That's exactly what happened with the book I just finished. I tried to read it years ago.
Yeah.
I couldn't, and now I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's just depending on the story, depending on what's going on.
Yeah.
For me at that time, like, I'm just more open to different stories and writing.
Well, speaking of starting books, do you DNF books if you're not enjoying them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Maybe I'll try again. Like you said, maybe I'll try again and at a different time. But I don't beat myself up about it. It's supposed to be enjoyable.
I thought it's an actuarial thing that you just finish something whether or not you're enjoying it. But no, they say life is too short to read books you're enjoying. What's the next book we're going to talk about?
So the next two books that I've actually brought. The one, I think I read this one, I'm trying to remember. It's quite a while ago. It's called A Splendid Exchange. It's How Trade Shaped the World. And I read it, I think, around 2009, 2010. It really, I never enjoyed history at school. I always thought it was such a waste. Why do we have to learn about these, you know, things that have happened and specific dates and things. And then at varsity, we do economics, which like opens up the world a little bit. And this book, maybe it was also the timing. It brings together history, it's how trade shaped the world. So it's literally how movements around the world and the trading between different civilizations at different times, the spice route, the silk route. And it just, you know, it was so fascinating. And I thought, like, why can't history at school be taught like that? Because then it makes it so relevant. And then you can understand even some of the things going on today. You know, as we were preparing and I was just paging through, and there's a lot in there about tariffs and trade tariffs and how, you know, and as the world becomes more global and, you know, work moves and jobs are impacted. And globalization's actually been going on for thousands of years. It's not just from when the World Trade Organization started. It's actually been going on for a very long time. So it helped me understand so much about the world we live in and in an interesting, accessible way.
That's what I wanted to ask, because I read the summary for this book, and even the summary just made it sound so compellingly and engagingly written.
Yes.
Is it one of those books that reads like a story?
Yes. Yes, it reads like a story, but it informs you, and it's an easy read.
Okay,
even though it's a long book, so I that's a book I could recommend. I've lent it out to friends, and I've made sure they've given it back to me. Yeah, so especially people, if you're trying to understand business, you're trying to understand the world dynamics. So politics is the other thing. I always try to like ignore, but you can't not, because the things that happen that are political, that are about power, that are about, you know, some things that have happened years and years ago still like reverberate, echo in what happens in our lives today.
When you hear trade, you think about goods and like physical silk, spices, all that. Does this also touch on trade of services, and, you know, does it sort of inspire or inform the work you do, or can you apply it to what we do?
Yeah, okay, this didn't go so much into services, but I think the concepts are the same, right? Because you're shifting from physical goods and labor into like knowledge work and now things and services that you can't not tangible, which also becomes very interesting in the current times and the rise of AI and Gen AI and what is knowledge work.
And do the principles of trade still apply?
Yeah. I haven't thought that deeply, Pam, but those are the questions.
People want to know.
Yes.
Who introduced you to this book, or where do you generally get your recommendations?
This book I found all by myself at Exclusive Books. So it was probably in the, you know, in the business section. And it's an interesting cover, so it looked accessible. Less so now. Now I browse the library in the store and the Audible, the Audible app. But just spending times in bookshops also and picking up a book and you know, reading a little bit of it gives you a sense. Yeah,
that's such a
so some have been lucky. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I have picked up some that fell in that DNF. Category as well.
That makes you appreciate the good ones.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite bookshop in South Africa or from your travels?
Exclusive books is just accessible. So yeah. I do end up in some of them. I like the one at Hyde Park because you can listen with olives and plates. So okay. Usually if I'm meeting someone there, then I'll just arrive early or leave later because it's super convenient. And then I try, you know, if I travel, I'm not beholden to a particular bookshop.
Okay, if you look around.
Flexible, yeah.
Okay. And I'm interested, is there anything about, does Africa feature in the story?
So there is trade with Africa, and that is very interesting because some of it was very surprising for me that, you know, it was prior to even, you know, we know a lot about the Dutch East India Company and the British East India Company and when they set up the trading posts at the Cape. But there was, even prior to that, trade between Asia and the African continent. There's evidence of it.
Yeah.
So it's not described in detail, but there is evidence of that trade, which I found interesting.
Yeah. There's a book called, I think it's called Fates and Fortunes of Africa. I don't know if you've heard of that. You might enjoy it. It goes into depth about, you know, from, you know, was it the libraries of Liberia or Libya, you know, from how thousands of years ago that there were actually like...
Yeah, Sikiru and Timbuktu, isn't it?
Yeah,
Timbuktu
exactly.
Has a lot of history.
I did want to ask, back to the, you know, trades of goods and so, are you ever tempted to, you know, has been a time when you thought, I'd like to trade in something more tangible than insurance or...
So I have toyed and I wonder also at you know, in a next career, because, you know, the whole concept of retirement is like totally outdated.
100-year
and it's just
life.
About, yeah, it's, you know, what will you do at different stages? And I do wonder about business, like setting up, running a business. And it's quite different. I mean, you said, oh, so I'm now at the head of a very large part of our group, but it's very different and sometimes harder to start something up from nothing and grow it. And I do toy with, you know, is that something I would like to do? Because I like the concept of business and working at something and exchange, which I suppose you could also call trade.
Yeah.
You deliver something that people want and they value. I don't know if I will do it, but it is a thought that's in my mind, because what we do is quite, it's a tertiary thing. It's abstract.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I will do it. I think the idea of farming is very romantic.
Why farming specifically? Or?
Because if you go hierarchy of needs, what do we need as people?
We need food and
farming. Look, it's important. So those are the most, you know, fundamental things that we need. But I think, you know, am I cut out for that? I'm not a morning person. I am not a morning person. I mean, every person, even remotely close to farming I've met, like, wakes up very early in the morning. Yeah, it might not be for me.
It's funny. So I was chatting to my colleagues here. One of our ex-colleagues here has left the World Actuarial to go and farm in Namibia, I think, take over the family farm. So we'll keep an eye out for your farmer prep.
Well, the part that I like, and maybe I wouldn't be the farmer, you know, quite so literally, but the concept of business and activity and commerce and its ability to create jobs and change, you know, the lives of people. So that is one thing that, in South Africa, we know we have an exceptionally youthful population, but it's also a population that's not economically active.
Yeah.
You know, every other part of the world, every other continent in the world have aging populations. So I do sometimes wonder, because what will it take for us to create enough activity? Because that's the resource, that's also a natural resource that we have.
Nice.
So maybe it's not farming, maybe it's something else. I like the idea, but maybe it's also another romantic notion of creating jobs. And I do sometimes wonder, you know, how best can I put my talents to use to do that? Yeah.
Do you find that you're able to do that and have the opportunity to do that in your, you know, in your current career?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the main things that adds meaning for me in my work. And I think for those of us in financial services, savings and investment in a company, in a country, so savings, domestic savings, which you then invest in the country, in infrastructure, in business, in driving the economy, it's a big factor. And depending on, you know, different economists have different frameworks, it is often the most important factor in taking countries out of poverty and shifting them. So in South Africa, we have a notoriously low household savings rate. Yeah. So I do think there's a lot of meaning in being in an industry where that is what we're trying to drive. And then from the savings that we gather, and then how we go and invest it, you know, whether it's through our asset managers or other funds, and how a lot of that is put into sustainable investments and infrastructure. And it's a cycle, and it's something we desperately need. So I think the work we do adds a lot of meaning. And then if I can get my act together in this new role, also creating an environment where people can enjoy what they're doing and find the meaning in their roles. So that's how I link what I do to doing something meaningful as work. Yeah.
That's actually, you know, it's quite a profound point, especially, you know, Old Mutual specifically, and I guess other major, you know, savings and investment houses, you have a say not only in individual savings, but also where that money can drive, you know, macro
exactly
and growth or not.
Exactly.
Your responsibility.
Exactly. And it's easy to miss that big picture when you just focus on what you do every day. But it's like everyone doing their piece in that chain. And when you put it all together, you know, that's the impact that we make as an industry.
Yeah. Mm. What's the next book we...
Okay, the next book I'm going to talk about is, it's very related to what we were talking about, okay, and business. And it's Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen. So I'm sure many people discovered this earlier in their careers. I was like a late, discovered this.
Yeah, it's from
much
Mike
later.
Steven.
Yeah, it's quite old, but I only discovered it in the last, say, 10 years. But the whole concept of design thinking, and there's a Harvard course called Disruptive Innovation, yeah, a short course that one can do online. And in the Innovator's Dilemma, and maybe it links to where I was career-wise, also in financial services in South Africa, and I was running our corporate business, which is an employee benefits, where there is no growth, there is no organic growth, or, you know, our economy is constrained. And the Innovator's Dilemma, Clayton Christensen, gives you a framework for how you can think about innovation and growth. And it gives you real examples and case studies of growth in a no-growth environment. You know, so how and it's framing your thinking. And I just fell in love with design thinking also as a concept and as a practice. And maybe because it's almost simple, but it's profound in how it helps you come up with solutions and find things that match what customers need, and it can drive a whole innovative business model.
But what is design thinking?
The simple approach and how I interpret it is, the example he gives is, you know, if customer is looking to do something, spend the time and the energy really understanding the problem. What is the job to be done? So it's focusing on the job to be done and not focusing on the specific product or solution that you want to sell. It's don't rush to what you think the answer is. Make sure you understand deeply what the challenge is. What is the pain point? So then provide a solution for that.
Even though the customer may not know that that's, it's like did Henry Ford say, if I'd asked people what they want, they would have said, give me faster horses or something?
Exactly.
That kind of thing.
It's exactly that. So I think the quote is, the customer's not looking for a 9-inch drill. It's focus on what is their job to be done and not the tool or the instrument or the product. Okay. And deeply understand your customers. And he gives a milkshake example where he was working with a company and he literally just went at different times into the store and sat and observed people buying milkshakes. So, you know, that store wanted to increase the sale of milkshakes. And so he sat there to understand, and he literally asked people, and he tried to figure out, what job is this milkshake doing at different times?
Is it bringing all the boys to the yard? The job of the milkshake.
In certain contexts, maybe. Yes. It gives a milkshake example, but it was just, you know, when it's the afternoon and it's after school and it's a parent coming in with their kids and their kids want something, or is it, you know, in the morning when people are going to work and how that, you know, so even something like a milkshake, yes. What job is it doing for the consumer at different times?
So that's outcome versus process.
Correct.
And what is the innovator's dilemma that the title refers to?
Sometimes you have a business model or a process or product that is doing very well, and you know it's difficult to disrupt that, and to innovate sometimes you have to disrupt something. So how do you do this? How do you set yourself up for innovation in different settings? So the one that I took out and that stayed with me a lot is, you know, if you've got something that's already working very well and the market is quite advanced already, you actually go to where customers are being, you know, overserved. And you look at simplifying things and making it cheaper and making it easier. And then you move up in terms of complexity and solution set. So the dilemma is, if you've got something working very well, it's difficult to disrupt it.
Okay.
So how do you set yourself up to, you know, how do you set yourself up to think about the market differently or to think about the space differently? And for our situation at that time, you know, the idea that stuck with me is, you know, you can set up a separate unit. You can separate things from, you know, one model that works very well and then focus on a different part. So the dilemma is how do you set up for innovation? And he makes the statement that you can't disrupt yourself, which was very interesting because I've often heard, like even when we're in strategy sessions and things, people say, we must disrupt ourselves before someone else comes to disrupt us.
Yeah.
And his view is actually, you can't disrupt yourself. It's very difficult to disrupt yourself. So you've got to be quite mindful in how you set yourself up to be able to do that disruption, you know, create a separate unit or have different KPIs. It's difficult to ask the same people to maintain one model, but then create something else that cannibalizes that. Because that's something you often hear also especially in large organizations. No, we can't do that because it'll cannibalize something that was very successful.
Yeah.
But maybe the market's moved. Maybe cannibalizing is okay, but you're never going to get the same people to do it.
Okay,
yeah.
So it can literally be as practical as having a separate team that acts as the disruptor.
It could be. Okay. Yeah, or you could buy the disruptor.
Okay.
You could, you know, so there could be lots of, and for me, it opened up the mind space in terms of actually there can be so many ways to be innovative, to think, to do things differently. You don't have to change everything about something that's working already or something that's very established.
Okay, so yeah. Is this one of the books that you've actually implemented things from? Or is it more mindset?
I think it's a bit of both. Yeah, so I think it's both. I have implemented some of the ideas from it. And some to a lot of criticism from other parts. Some worked well, some didn't work well. Yes. So
okay.
It's both. It's affected my mindset of how I think about things, and also not get depressed when there's no growth externally, but you actually, you know, you have to deliver for shareholders. You have to deliver for your staff. You have to deliver for customers that actually, you know, you just got to look at things a little differently.
I think that's such an important message to share, that, you know, you have tried things and some things haven't worked. And that's okay. You need to, you know, take risks. And as an actuary, it's difficult to hear. And then the other thing you touched on is, I'm hearing a lot, you know, from obviously it affects our clients and then our business, is how the market is not growing. So,
yeah.
you have to, you know, steal market share or, some, as you say, create value in other ways.
Yeah, I think that's a difficulty right now for lots of companies operating in, you know, locally, is there isn't a lot of, we need our GDP to be much higher than it is. And, you know, on the one hand, I think, especially as large corporates, we have a responsibility to support and help create more activity, you know, whether that's directly through helping fund small and medium-sized businesses, startups, entrepreneurs. But also then we have to think quite innovatively. Mm. You can't, you know, because we've had great equity market returns over the last 12 months, the last 6 months, but you can have great share prices without the actual economic activity on the ground, you know, being that that positive. So you're going to have to think very differently. I think we also need to think more beyond our borders, which and into Africa. Most trade or successful trade, inter-country, you know, operations with companies happens closest to your borders. And if you look at Africa as a continent, we do very little trade with each other on the continent. And you know, there's a lot that we get from other parts of the world. But maybe there's also an opportunity for us to think about how do we generate our own activity. Yeah, it's not an easy time to be a head of a business. No.
But if anyone can do it, it's you.
Oh.
What's the next book we're going to?
So this one, I actually cannot remember much of the but yeah. I do remember also, it's this 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And maybe that's the theme is continuing from the trade and where it's Yuval Noah Harari, who also wrote the book Sapiens. That was unfortunately one of the books I started and I couldn't finish. I do have it on my shelf. Did you read it?
I read, that's the only book of his I've read.
This book I managed to finish.
Okay.
And this was quite an easy read, but and there's such a lot going on in the world. I felt it was a nice way to try, well, I only felt that after I'd completed it, but to process everything going on. I mean, it's in, I think it was in four or five different sort of themes. How many parts? Yeah, it's five parts, and it was different themes, you know, from technology, politics. It covers, he's got a part called Despair and Hope, so terrorism, war.
And this was pre-COVID.
This was, and this is the nice thing about exclusive books. It tells you when you bought the book. This is 2018. So it was 2 years pre-COVID. But I think a lot of it is just still so relevant about resilience. So they're just like, they're essays on these different topics. But there's just like such a lot. It feels like our world is so chaotic at the moment. So I chose this book because it still feels so relevant, even though, you know, it's from like more than 7 years ago now.
Yeah.
But the world just seems to have gotten more, yeah, like more stirred up, more chummed up.
More polarized.
Yeah.
Yeah, more yeah. Tense. Are there any specific lessons from there that stand out, or any of the essays that
I think of? It was the general theme of not just taking things at face value, because there's so many strong polarizing views, and it's easy to, you know, you just listen to, and there's a lot of propaganda. There's a lot of people, and maybe this is what's become heightened, you know, over the last few years, is there's there's X, there's, you know, there's Instagram, there's all the social media, there's all these different groups, there are all these different influences, and people have such strong views. But it's, I think it's just saying, just take a step back and look at what's behind it, and not just take the things at its superficial level. I mean, it also talked about, you know, humility and how we're all just people, which I quite enjoyed. Like, it covers very deep topics, but then it's also It's like as every human being, we're just, yeah, universal topics.
So is this more his, you know, sort of personal musings rather than his, what's he, is he a historian? What's his?
I don't know what to call him.
Anthropologist?
I think.
He's obviously a great thinker. So
yes. And I mean, the book says it's an exploration of what it means to be human in an age of bewilderment, which is kind of how I experience it. Yes. Well, he specializes in world history.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is very curious for someone. I did not enjoy history. And I ended up like there are books that, you know, historians and economists and yeah, it's just have brought the topic alive.
It's sort of like that thing about how a good teacher can make or break a subject.
Yeah.
I remember at school, my history teacher said, no, the reason we study history is so that we can speak to our husband's friends when we accompany him to like events and things. And we have things to talk about.
Were you in a small, were you, did you grow up in a small town, Pam?
I did. I went to an all-girls school. So okay. But I also find it's those, you know, what you might think are not useful subjects, history, I studied Latin, English. Those are the ones that have kind of stuck with me and I feel have lessons that can be applied, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we as an actuary, we're not have used maths. But history you might use.
History you might use, especially because of the times we're living in and it feels like history is being made every single day. Yeah. You know, sometimes you see a headline and you think, oh, this has to be fake news. This can't be real. But half of those crazy headlines are actually real. So we're living through quite a crazy time. But, you know, reading things like this book on the list, yes, we don't know where it will end up, but just helps you ground yourself as a person. Like certain things are just universal, like you say, and we can still just focus on being good human beings and kind to one another and doing good work and, you know, trying to find to live a life of meaning and be happy.
That locus of control,
yes,
right?
Yes. In the last few months where, you know, work has felt a little bit wild, I've had to remind myself those things, that actually just to remember to make time for simple things that I enjoy. And as crazy as things become, work is still just work, you know. And I think especially maybe, yeah, it's easy to want to do things like really well and put in all your effort if you see, but, you know, just having healthy boundaries with all the crazy going on.
What are some of the simple, like, relaxing or fun rituals that you like to enjoy?
Yeah, so I love being out in nature, but I'm not a hiker. I'm not an exerciser. I'm not a hiker. It must be the gentle activity.
So sit at a restaurant looking at the mountains. I don't know the sea.
Sitting outdoors at a restaurant. Yes, you've got me. So that's it. So outdoors at a nice location. Johannesburg was great in terms of open gardens during spring, which I really enjoy. So I did go to one 2 weekends ago. So outdoors, you know, things with close friends. I have, like I mentioned, some of my friends from university, few other friends from along the way, and some of my family up in Johannesburg. Just spending time with them, just being, I find quite nice. Traveling. So half the reason I chose the MBA I did was because of the travel, which I'm not ashamed to say. Yes, it was in Spain, but every module was in a different part. So I traveled quite a bit, which was wonderful because it just opens your mind and experience different things. Also, every time you came back home, I was like, oh, we live in a pretty amazing place. And yes, there's some stuff that, you know, is really doesn't work and we can improve. But we also have some really amazing things. So it just makes you appreciate home as well. I've started knitting recently, which apparently is very good for stress management. And I'm finishing a little baby blanket for a friend of mine who had a baby last October. So the baby's almost one.
Yeah, I knit very fast.
My goal is, and they live in the UK, so at least it's winter has come back around. My goal is that the baby has that blanket for this winter. I'm three-quarter of the way through.
You told me today that there's something at the Bioscope at 44 Stanley where you knit and watch a movie.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I usually have Netflix on and I'm knitting, but that's an option. Yeah.
Oh.
It is relaxing. It's repetitive. It just helps. It's supposed to be
Yeah,
good.
it's the right level of creativity and production.
Yes.
Yeah,
Yes.
productivity.
Yes. Yes. And I'm hoping to improve my garden at home. So I'm spending a bit of time in the garden and just, I can't claim to be the gardener, but I do select the plants.
Do you select where they get planted?
Sometimes.
Oh
Yeah.
gosh. Okay. I think are we on our last book that we're going to discuss?
This is a more personal one, and I suppose because I did have it on my shelf. So it's called Children of Sugarcane. It's a South African author. Her name is Joanne Joseph. So it is fiction, but is inspired by the life story of her grandmother. And it's very nicely written. I enjoyed it was easy to read, nice descriptions, quite vivid, and I could feel the characters. So the Joanne's grandmother was a indentured laborer from India, and my ancestors are the same. So my great grandparents came as indentured laborers to South Africa. So I think reading it was. It felt very personal. It felt very emotional. It felt the experiences of those characters, were probably the experiences of my ancestors. And at some times it was quite painful, but it felt good. It was the first time that I read a book, a story that could have been, is probably so close to the lived experience of my ancestors. And it was interesting. Joanne is a presenter, and she's a journalist, and she was at an event that we had, and I said to her, I really enjoyed reading your book, and
An
it was
all-meeting
wonderful.
event.
Yes, she was one of the MCs for us, and she said, she was grateful, but it was interesting. She said she had received such mixed feedback that, not all of the history of indentured laborers is easy, or, it's hard, it's painful, and she writes in a very, it's a very real sort of brutal,
Confronting.
yeah, the, and she said there were people who said to her they felt ashamed, which I found very interesting, because it is what it is, and that is probably, the conditions on the ships that the laborers came on, the situation where in the accommodation they had before getting onto the ship, how they were processed once they got to Natal, and they were put into, very difficult living conditions. People died in the process. She talks about rape. She talks about, some of the harder things people had to do to survive. So it's interesting when people, there aren't many books like this. There are books from other people who've written about the history of Indian people in South Africa and moving, but this is a very gritty, raw, and human experience of what people probably did go through. So I enjoyed it. In fact, this was a book a friend of mine bought for me, and she bought for our circle of friends. And wasn't always easy to read, but I feel richer having read it.
Do you feel closer to your great grandparents and their story, or?
I feel for them. I feel how brave they were. I have no idea, because the people who got on those ships, they had varied circumstances. Some didn't realize what they were signing up for. Some had even worse circumstances that they were leaving behind. Some were running away from some sort of situation. So I have no idea what their situation was. But regardless, they went on this totally unknown, they were brave. They were brave. So yeah, I'm grateful, and maybe, yes, I'm I didn't think of them as people in those situations until reading the book.
This is actually the second time this book is made onto the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Marusha Narayanasamy brought this one. And I think probably had similar feeling.
Oh, wow.
And I asked her something which I was quite interested in. And, you know, the Indian South African community is such a vibrant, strong culture in South Africa. Have you been to India, and do you feel, you know, connection there as well? Or is it very much a South African Indian
culture that you identify with? That's a really good question, because of our very specific history in South Africa, and we were all labeled, and, you know, my entire life, every form I'd fill in, like whether it was at school or you're applying for something, you'd have to tick that you're Indian. And I remember finding it quite hilarious because I'd never been to India until I was in my late 30s. And when I lived in Mexico, I'd never been to India. And when I had to describe to people, and I'd say to the mix, I'm South African, and they wouldn't, you know, I'd keep saying, I'm South African, I'm South African. And then when I say I'm Indian South African, but they're like, oh, okay, because they couldn't relate. But, you know, and after I got back is when I decided, well, my next trip will be to India. So I did go to India. I spent like over 3 weeks. My first trip was more... So my ancestors are from the south of India. So the trip I did was the south of India. So, and every like town or village I went to, I was like, I could be from here. All these people. It is very strange. It is very strange. India is a very populous country. And so it's quite jarring. Yeah. But I felt more South African after my trip to India than before. And you realize, you know, I'm third generation South African, which is not that much, but we are South African. Yes, the food is, you know, a lot of our food is influenced with theirs. The culture, it's a rich culture, clothing, food, religion, some rituals, some traditions, but we're different. We're South African. I identify as South African. I do feel like a giant there, so maybe like a few generations are eating very different food. People are like quite petite. But yeah, I identify more strongly as South African because I had nothing in common with those people except for those elements, you know, that my ancestors brought.
Definitely, it's so nice to live in a place where you do feel like you belong.
Yes, 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 it is. And we something else interesting that I think as South Africans, we're still defining the identity of what it means to be South African, because we're still so attached to, you know, because of our history of apartheid, etc., where you have to tick boxes. And it was something the Mexicans had said to me, because when I worked there, there was a project team from South Africa, and we're a very diverse country, so people come. And they said to me, we are all very different. They don't experience us as a South African identity. We're all like quite different. So that struck me then, that we haven't yet, I think maybe we're in the process, and maybe 30 years feels like a long time, but it's actually a short time when you look at how old some other countries are, and maybe we're still forging, you know, what is the uniquely South African identity.
Yeah. And how much diversity do we actually want to keep? Because that does make us stronger and richer.
Exactly. Exactly. And that balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Acknowledging we're different, but we have something in common. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I wanted to ask, so, you know, you've been at Old Mutual your whole career since 2002. What are some of the big moments or highlights that you remember? You know, because I think so much has changed at Mutual in that time.
My biggest highlights, I think, will link to people, and not so much, and maybe a particular team that I was with, and something we've achieved, something we've done that, you know, I could feel really proud of, that I was part of. My time in Mexico, I loved for myself. The project was not a success, which was very hard for me to say. I could not say that for years without breaking out into tears. That, you know, we tried really hard. Everyone worked really hard. But at the end of the day, it's very, very difficult to make something work over, you know, that physical distance and cultural distance and time zone and et cetera, et cetera. My biggest highlight has been the opportunities to learn and grow. We did some great things, you know, as a team where I was part of. I've spent a lot of time in our mass and foundation business, which they just has an amazing culture and an attitude of just like, you know, doing things and exceeding targets and exceeding plans. And it's just like this winning culture and everyone in the business, you know, feels it. I remember a time when, you know, things were very bad, the economy wise, but these guys were just still hitting and exceeding their sales targets. And our CEO at the time said, please don't tell that business there's almost a recession in the country because they're still, you know, focused and they're
keeping us afloat.
And then I was part of the team that took our tax-free savings. We launched a digital tax-free savings account, which, you know, as a project team, it's just this, the feeling of when everyone's aligned around something and, you know, it goes live. It's just, it's very, very special. So there's been special things every, and then I'm still very biased to our corporate team because I've only just left them and I still have separation anxiety. You know, we launched our SME division. We bought a stake in a lending company. We've put, you know, over 700 million into lending to small and medium-sized businesses, and those are the sorts of things that like make me warm and fuzzy.
What's so exciting and interesting is that, you know, how your personal career and history and story have like meshed with the bigger Old Mutual story, which is it's special. And shows, you know, if you're excited and passionate about what you do, then that's good for the company and ultimately society as well.
Yeah, I know I'm a bit of an outlier. I think from my class from varsity, I'm the only one who hasn't changed companies. But I've changed jobs, you know, many times. So I don't think it's good or bad. I think, you know, as long as you're growing, as long as you feel you're adding value and you're delivering work that's valued and appreciated, then there's no
wrong.
Okay,
well, I think we've come to the end of the book. So to recap, we spoke about Little Women by Louisa Alcott, A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World by William Bernstein, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Harari, The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen, and Children of Sugar Cane by Joanne Joseph. Don't know if you're prepared for this question, but if I was going to be very cruel and send you to a desert island with just one of these books, which one would it be and why?
Oh, wow. I think I'd take the 21 Lessons because it covers such a broad spectrum and it gives food for thought to sort of meditate on different aspects. It's the book I spoke about the least because I can't remember half of what I read. But it's broad enough and it helps you process things, but I think it covers like everything that one should meditate on for the future.
Yeah, and hopefully it's one of those where you can reread and take different lessons every time.
Yeah, I think I'm going to reread that one. Yeah.
I think I've added it to my TBR as well.
Awesome.
But to thank you for coming on the podcast, I have some other books to add to your TBR. To thank you for coming, I have two book gifts for you. The first one is one of my favorite books. It's originally in French by Boris Vian. This translation is called Mood Indigo. I know it as Foam of the Days. And it's the most quirky, whimsical, surreal kind of story about, you know, these young people in Paris. And I just thought, you know, for your very serious corporate job, if you are ever looking for something more whimsical, it might be a nice one. And then I couldn't choose between that one and this one called Range by David Epstein. It's giving Brett, as the young people would say. But this one was recommended by Elsa. She's recently read it and loved it. And I think it's you know, the case for being a generalist rather than a specialist and how that can transform the world or society.
Thank you so much.
So hopefully a book for every mood, to say thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to start with this.
Dying to hear what you think. It's a very, you know, specific type of book. But if you appreciate it, it's one of those that, you know, has stuck with me. Before we go, where can people reach you if they want to follow your journey or see what you're up to?
People can reach me on LinkedIn. I'm not a prolific poster. I post occasionally, but you can see sort of, you know, what I'm involved in, what I'm up to, and reach out to connect.
Amazing. Any last thoughts for our listeners?
I think remember to keep an open mind, be grateful for everything we have, which is a lot. And books are an amazing way to do lots of things, to escape, also to get, you know, new insights and new ways of thinking. And you've definitely, you know, this conversation's also been really awesome. Thank you.
Oh, and for me, it's been such a privilege. Thanks, Prabhashini.